Quorum being present, the Committee on Local Government and Elections will come to order. We're going to do the bills in the following order: Senate File 864, then 1673, then 1668, and 1667. So Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate File 864 is a provision to authorize employees of local units of government to participate in the state's long-term care insurance program. Currently, state employees are eligible for this program. It is an optional choice for them. Expanding it to include local units of government accomplishes several things. One is to make an important part of retirement and health care decisions available to our local employees. Secondly, it sends an important public policy message. As our population ages, it is stressing our current Medicare Medicaid system, and having long-term care is part of a smart retirement plan and something we should be encouraging in the public in general, and can do that by expanding this to our local government employees. There is no fiscal impact to the state. This is optional for employees. And with that, I do have some testifiers available.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Could you state your name for the record, please? Your testifier.
Harris, go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Jeremy Zychek.
Proceed, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon again. My name is Jeremy Zychek. I'm the benefits manager for Hennepin County, and I'm here to testify on behalf of Hennepin County and Hennepin County supportive Senate File Number 864. Hennepin County does not currently provide our employees access to a group long-term care insurance program. From the year 2002 to 2008, Hennepin County did offer a long-term care insurance program through Aetna Life and achieved a participation rate of about 7%. But in late 2008, the county received notification from the vendor that the contract would not be extended due to the fact that Aetna Life made a business decision to exit the group long-term care market. Aetna allowed employees to convert their coverage into individual policies established through a trust. Aetna did not provide the county with a percentage of employees that opted to convert the policy, but we do know that many policyholders had reservations regarding the trust. For the past 3 years, Hennepin County has kept its pulse on the long-term care market with the intent of offering a group voluntary program again in the future. We have weighed the decision carefully as we have observed a lot of change in the long-term care market. Hennepin County has 7,254 benefit-eligible employees. Many of them are unionized, including 4,121 eligible AFSCME employees, which could potentially benefit from access to the Minnesota Employee Group Long-Term Care Insurance Program. Hennepin County believes it's good policy to encourage employees to plan for their own long-term care needs. We support Senate File 864 because it expands access to long-term care insurance for other public employers in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Hennepin County and in support of Senate File Number 864.
Thank you. Is Renee Kirshner here?
She's not. She's not here.
Melanie Austin?
She is.
Good afternoon. My name is Renee Kirshner. I am a human resources director, and I work for Chisago County, Minnesota. I am here to testify on behalf of Chisago County and our position on Senate File 864, long-term care insurance. Chisago County is in support of this bill. Chisago County currently participates in the municipal pool offered through a broker agency. As such, employees opting to purchase this voluntary coverage are subject to 8% to 10.5% broker's fees. If all political subdivisions were allowed to access the state's long-term care plan, the cost would be less expensive, allowing employees to purchase a higher level of coverage at about the same rate as they are currently paying. With the state offering a $100 per year tax deduction to those who participate in the long-term care coverage, this makes it an attractive benefit to those employees who choose to protect their financial assets in the future. I would encourage this bill to go forward, allowing political subdivisions to access the state's long-term care plan. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Is there any questions for that witness? Seeing none, Melanie Ott?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Melanie Alt. I'm the Director of Human Resources for Anoka County. Anoka County would like to see the employees of local governments in Minnesota be able to purchase long-term care insurance through the state's plan, commonly noted as MPEL. You should have a sheet in your packets. One page has a little chart in the middle. The state of Minnesota currently administers this plan. It is voluntary. It is employee paid. It is continually offered to new hires throughout the state. Initial rollout costs could be diminished through use of technology and timing. There had been a question about adverse selection. There's no evidence to suggest that local government employees are any more or less of a risk than state employees. They work in the same industry. There's no evidence to suggest that only high-risk people would choose to participate in the MPEL plan. Instead, people from all risk levels would likely to choose MPEL, and it has been noted it is at a lower cost than the municipal pool. MPEL is community-rated, so the risk is spread across the entire community of purchasers, regardless of age, health status, or claims history. There's an economy of scale. Many local governments do not have the resources to duplicate the state's efforts to intensively research, evaluate, and select a carrier and a product at a competitive price. By rolling out the state's plan to local governments, it makes it an easy choice. There's a cost savings, as has been noted. There's a comparison there of just a sample benefit that someone could choose. This one happens to be 10.5% higher under the municipal plan. Access to the state's widespread, less expensive plan would also require private vendors to be more competitive. We heard that Aetna from Hennepin County had withdrawn from the market. We're looking for a good plan. The lower the premium, more employees will purchase it. It's a voluntary participation. Making it easy and convenient for local governments to offer long-term care insurance boosts the number of Minnesotans planning for their financial future instead of using medical assistance at state taxpayers' expense. It's good public policy. We're not looking to change the type of coverage. We're looking to keep it optional. We're looking to keep it still employee paid. We simply want access to this type of plan. You also should have four letters of support. Sherburne County, Redwood County, MICA, and City of Arden Hills. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Any questions? Members? Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is it Melanie?
Yes.
Or Ms. All? If more city employees left the municipal pool and went into the state pool, wouldn't that drive up the cost of the municipal pool even more for those remaining people who are left in the city pool?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's my understanding that the municipal pool plan is the same type of plan through the same carrier as the state's plan. And so the difference would be in the administrative fees that would be charged. And so that would be up to the broker whether they would see fit to increase the fees even further or decrease them, depending on the numbers of people that participated or not.
Mr. Chair, then.
Senator Sieben.
I think what you were just saying then is that if more people leave it, then it is likely that that would probably drive up the cost for the municipal pool, though. Understand that it's up to the broker, the overall number of people who are left in the pool, but it seems like if there's already a difference in price, then more people leave the city pool, it's more likely that that cost will continue to rise.
Ms. Hall.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I can't comment on how they structure or project their costs. They have told their members have shared with me that they've been put on notice that the municipal pool will not accept new members 1 year from now.
Any other questions? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm following Senator Sieben's line of thinking, which is wondering what would happen to those employees who are currently in the municipal pool. And as more employees do go to the, I think it's the MEPL pool, those employees who have the most health conditions might not be accepted into the new pool. And so we might end up with sort of a reverse adverse selection. In other words, I'm just concerned that the employees who stay in the municipal pool will be those employees who have the who are not able to transfer. And I'm wondering about the sustainability of that. If all of the good risks transfer out, what's going to happen then to the remaining pool?
Ms. Hall?
Mr. Chair, Senator, typically the benefit is made available without regard to age or health status, for example, upon new hire. For people who are already hired, it's a new benefit. There would be a period of time where folks could enroll. From time to time, there has also been an open enrollment period as well, a window.
Just to follow up, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Nelson.
Thank you. So new enrollees, it's a group plan, so there's no adverse selection. But for the current employees, there is a selection element then of current employees being able to move to the new program. I assume they would have to go through underwriting.
Ms. Al.
Mr. Chair and Senator, that is not my understanding, because it would be a new benefit made available, a new plan, if you will, made available, the MPEL plan versus the MuniPEL plan made available.
Senator Nelson.
Well, that was, I think Senator Benson might have a follow-up to that.
So
my question is about underwriting for existing employees.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson and Ms. Ault will please correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding that an entire county or city would have to choose to access this new long-term care provision. An individual employee couldn't just move over. It would have to be offered as a package of benefits at, is that correct, at the community level, at the local government entity level?
Ms. Hall.
Mr. Chair, it would be offered to a jurisdiction, for example. It would be optional if the jurisdiction wanted to offer it, but if they did, it would be a choice to their employees, similar to deferred compensation. If one person wants the state of Minnesota's deferred comp plan, the jurisdiction then needs to offer it to all employees. They can also choose to offer additional deferred comp plans as well.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I understand correctly, then there are no underwriting requirements for employees as they move to this new plan. That's actually what I'm trying to drill down to. Are there underwriting requirements as a jurisdiction would choose to move to this new state a long-term care plan? Will there be any underwriting requirements for existing employees?
Resolved.
Mr. Chair and Senator, it's my understanding there would not, similar to how the state rolls it out to new hires now anyways.
So, thank you. But my question isn't new hires, it's existing employees.
But for the Mr. Chair.
Resolved.
Senator, it would be new to the whole jurisdiction, and so in that sense, all the employees would be new.
Thank you.
Hey, Senator Sieben, did you have another question?
I did. Thank you. Ms. Ault, if the municipal pool is no longer allowing new employees in, and then it seems to reason that eventually that plan is going to go away. So wouldn't the lack of one additional public pool of public employees ultimately drive up the cost for everyone for long-term care insurance? Because there'll be the state pool, and then there'll no longer be a municipal pool. And then that's just one less actor in the field to make the rates go up. More likely the rates will go up for everyone if they can't bid against one another.
Ms. Ault, do you care to comment? Was that a question? Or? Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, right now the government employee access to long-term care is completely bifurcated. There's no competition now. By allowing local units of government to choose the municipal pool or the state pool, that actually increases competition. And the municipal pool will either have to step up or suffer the consequences. And by giving the employees the choice, by giving municipalities, local governments, and counties the choice, they get to choose the best value for their employees. So long term, the employees end up better off. And we can't overlook the fact that there is also a private market for long-term care. And if the private market wants a piece of a very large pool, they're going to have to compete for it as well. And so I think really broadening access to a pool sends a signal to the muni pool that they're going to have to step up. They no longer have a secure place in the market.
Senator Stephen.
Mr. Chair, I don't mean to belabor the point, Senator Benson, but if the municipal pool isn't allowing new employees to come into it, isn't that what I heard? Mm-hmm. Then how is their long-term viability assured? I mean, they have a set number of people who are in it, and it's unlikely that it will become more competitive in terms of rates because there aren't new people coming into it.
Senator Stephen. Senator.
Mr. Benson. Chair and Senator Stephen. Those employees are not compelled to stay in that pool. They can move to the new pool if we give them access. They don't have to stay in the muni pool, and the muni pool will have to change their behavior if they want to keep those employees. We're not stranding people. We're not telling people you have to stay where you're at. We're actually broadening options and hopefully lowering the cost. And if the muni pool can't compete, they can't compete.
Right, but Mr. Chair, that's my point. Then it doesn't if their premiums are already higher, they're not being able to bring in more people to help broaden the risk and lower their rates, which right. is the way it works. It's most like, I mean, I'm just thinking then that the muni pool will go away and then there will be less competition.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Stephen, we mustn't forget the private market is still available. What we're really concerned with is offering the lowest cost, best available option to the broadest number of public employees. We're not concerned with the viability of a particular insurance pool. We want options because long-term care insurance is going to be a critical part of Minnesota public policy going forward. And one of the ways we send a market signal that it is important is by broadening access to all of our public employees instead of just the state pool.
I understand that Nathan Morocco was here. Mr. Morocco, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nathan Morocco. I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division. In that role, I oversee both the State Employee Group Insurance Program that you all participate in, as well as the Public Employee Insurance Program.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, certainly, I essentially want to make myself available to the committee as a resource. Senator Benson and I had an opportunity to talk more about the bill yesterday. I think, you know, we're pretty much in agreement on the principles of the bill in terms of, you know, of what it's doing and what it's trying to accomplish, and certainly, you know, understand the sort of the catalyst here for the desire to bring in broader pools. So I'll keep my testimony short, and I think you understand the issues. Largely, they revolve around really two main principles. One being that there is a higher administrative burden of administering a program to local units of government. That's largely because, as a state, we're on one large central payroll system. We're rolling out a long-term care benefit along with all the other benefits that you participate in. So when we meet with state employees, we're also talking about health and dental and life insurance and those sorts of things. As we develop communications, we're doing one communication for the entire state. So the administrative complexity comes into needing to then cater to the individual units, their individual payroll systems, or their individual communication mechanisms. And so there's a higher administrative burden there. In terms of the underwriting principles, which some of you have touched base on here, I think everything that's been stated up to this point are accurate. You know, I think there certainly are considerations from an underwriting perspective. You know, there may be individual losers and winners in this equation. You know, the existing pool could become more expensive because there may be a burden issue. There may not. There will be an administrative issue that may raise prices. And so, you know, there may be an impact on that pool. It may increase the rates. However, for some of the locals, it may bring some of their rates down. So, again, like in any pooling situation, you're going to have winners or losers. It really, I think, is a policy decision as to whether or not, you know, you want to sort of create that through, like, the winners and losers through legislation or through some other mechanism. Senator Benson and I also talked a little bit about some of the broader concepts around long-term care. Certainly, to the extent that people don't carry long-term care, we would expect at some point, should they need those services, they will end up in the state system somewhere, and certainly understand that that's a consideration as a legislature that you may want to consider, you know, the state's input on long-term care in general in aggregate. But again, those that's a policy decision to weigh what's the impact going to be to current state employees who pay the full premium, who may be impacted by this, and to the extent that is offset by some of the savings that could occur to the local units or perhaps in other sectors of state government like some of the human services programs. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have specific to the pool or the Muni pool or the MPEL pool.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Anyone else here to testify for or against Senate File 864? Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I just have a question. I just need some clarification. I sell long-term care insurance. I just need to make sure there's not a conflict of interest here. I would assume not. There's nothing at all.
You're asking me.
I am, as the chair.
Get charged with anything at any time and any
place. I would assume that it's not at all.
I don't believe it treats you any different.
Well,
than any other.
I'll just make a comment. I support long-term care insurance and the fact that we absolutely need to get more. We need to encourage people to purchase long-term care insurance just like they fund their retirements and their children's education. But since I'm not clear, I'm going to abstain just out of abundance of due caution.
Okay. Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment on Mr. Morico, I hope I pronounced that correctly. He came to my office, helped me understand some of the administrative hurdles that might be part of this, and I have pledged to help in whatever way I can between management and budget and local units of government to make sure that this is more, as it benefits the counties, that they take on a due part of the administrative burden, and so we can minimize the impact on our state administrative process.
Thank you. Sir, do you wish to testify?
Yes.
State your name for the tape, please.
Mr. Chair, my name is John Thorson with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Council 5. We represent both state university employees and a fair amount of local government folks in the Twin Cities, Duluth and the Arrowhead. I guess I testified today expressing concerns related to the administrative costs as described by Mr. Morocco. We support, again, we have a foot in each canoe on this issue in terms of representing state employees purchasing long-term care in the existing state pool, and concerns about bringing folks into that pool, both the administrative costs of dealing with more than one employer, not knowing the experience rating of the folks coming in. There's methods for doing that, and I believe I heard Senator Benson say that's one of the things she'd be willing to work on in figuring out how to isolate those additional costs to do this in a way that doesn't pass those costs on to the existing state employees covered under the program. And we do support the goal on a policy level of extending long-term care insurance. We support finding better and cheaper options for local government employees to do this. and I guess would seek to find ways to have something like this happen that doesn't pass the cost on to the existing beneficiaries of the insurance.
So, Mr. Thorson, are you suggesting something like some underwriting prior to open enrollment or during, or am I understanding what you're saying?
We're getting a bit out of my wheelhouse in terms of crafting how one might address this, but I think something that partitions the risk with the new folks coming in until there is an experienced rating or somehow capture some of the additional administrative cost for the new folks coming in might be a way to do that.
Senator Benson, did you have a comment? Or?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of these administrative costs have been brought up, and this bill has been sitting out for more than a year. If you look at Senate File 864, it's been around for a while. And I have asked that the order of magnitude of administrative costs be estimated. So we don't know, and nobody's been able to quantify that. I understand that. But we don't know if this is fractions of a penny per employee over the course of a month, or if this is dollars. And just to be clear with the committee, I do not see local employees being fundamentally different than state employees in their risk assessment. I cannot think of a logical reason why a government employee at a county office would be different than a government employee in a state building across the street. And so when we talk about risk pool and how that could be significantly different, I don't think a high-level scrutiny would support that assessment. I don't see significant risk in administrative costs because the counties are willing to work with the state on this. And I don't see tangible significant risk in expanding this pool.
I think, though, Senator Benson, that could be somewhat speculative because we don't really know, and the group has the choice of moving in or not moving in, and what drives that decision might be something to look at. But Senator Roebling, did you have a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I do think that Senator Benson is fundamentally correct. And we really can't control, just like if I were in a private pool, I can't control who else comes in. And, you know, eventually that pool may change and my costs may end up going up, my premiums may be raised slightly. But I don't know that we should be trying to hold that down just for one group of people when I think our interest is trying to get as many people into long-term care as possible. And at this point, it sounds like the premiums will come down for the local units of government employees who might want to come into the pool. At some point in time, the premiums are going to probably go up. I mean, that's just the way it is. Our population is aging, and they may have to raise those premiums to cover themselves for the future. But I think it is in the state taxpayers' general to their benefit that we would try and get as many people into long-term care as possible. So I am supportive of this, and when the time comes, I will certainly move the bill.
Okay. Well, I would agree it's in our interest to get people in the plan. I'm just a little cautious about rolling large groups into the state plan. It's been suggested for the health plan, too, and I'm not sure how much difference it is, but we haven't gone along and done that, so... At any rate, any other additional comments or questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Stevens.
Just to build on your point there, I know a while ago I had an idea, or not an idea, but I had a bill that would allow small business owners to buy into the state pool, and that was, pretty resoundingly rejected. But I'm wondering if the municipal pool has thought about allowing expanding access to its pool under the same guise so that the premiums could come down for everyone, because obviously we want more people to have it, and if the thinking is if moving more people into the state pool would bring everyone's costs down, why not just allow more people into the municipal pool?
Anyone care to comment on that? Apparently not.
I can't speak to anyone.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Roebling moves that Senate File 864 be recommended to pass and be referred to general order and placed on general orders. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No.
No.
Okay. The bill passes and placed on general orders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Senator Benson. The second bill on the agenda is Senate File 1673. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Senator John Carlson, Senate District 4, and I do have the A3 amendment.
Senator Carlson moves the has the A3 amendment. Senator Roebling moves the A3 amendment. Any discussion regarding the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. Amendment's adopted. Senator Carlson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1673, as amended, does two things. Under the section that requires a performance bond of $75,000, there's been a history of linking this performance bond to the amount required for putting contracts out for bid for municipalities. The last time that that was increased from $75,000 to $100,000, they forgot to tweak this one as well. So this is sort of a little housekeeping. And then tying this, by changing the language, this then would always tie this dollar amount threshold for performance bonds to the requirement for putting contracts out for bid for these municipalities. The second thing that it does applies only to townships. Basically, right now you have townships that contract with usually a local contractor to clear the snow and ice off of the roads and to grade them in the summertime. And these contracts are usually multiple-year contracts. The reason that they do these multiple-year contracts is so that the contractor knows that they can afford to invest in a piece of equipment, and then that way they can keep their costs down, and so it keeps the cost down to all the township residents. And so they do these anywhere from 2, 3, and even as much as 5-year contracts. And so what we're trying to do here is to remove the concept of removing snow and ice and routine road grading from this threshold. It's not very often that even in a multiple-year contract that these contractors would even reach that dollar amount, but should they, again, it's routine maintenance. It doesn't have to do with building something new. It doesn't have to do with putting in new culverts. It's just simply some routine road maintenance. This particular question came to me from Cass County, and the local townships in Cass County were working with the contractor, and they all agreed that there was some problems with the language, and so we went to the Minnesota Association of Townships to see if we could figure out how to best accommodate those townships and some of these irregularities in statute. So I guess at this point, Mr. Chair, if it's all right with you, I would turn this over to Mr. Kent Sulem from the Minnesota Association of Townships.
Sulem, welcome to the committee. State your name for the tape, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kent Sulem, General Counsel at the Minnesota Association of Townships. And as Senator Carlson indicated, this was an issue that arose in his district, and we were called on it both by the township and by the senator and by the House member who's working on this issue. And we do have a wide variety of contracts for road maintenance that are let. Some do seasonal contracts. Some do once a year, cover all the work. Some do the multiple year contracts. And so the thresholds do vary. But what happened was the township had contacted me after one of our training sessions and said, well, what is a public works contract under the statute? That under current law, if you hit a $75,000 threshold, you're required to have a payment and performance bond. And I said, well, we really don't have a definition. Statute doesn't clearly define it. I checked with some colleagues, and the consensus was that bonds were not being issued for routine types of maintenance work, that wasn't deemed public works, like a road construction, a bridge installation, major culvert work, that type of thing, water, wastewater type, sewer lines, those would all be considered public works, but the routine stuff was not. But I told them I couldn't give them an absolute answer that a court would agree with that because it wasn't defined. And so they went back to their contractor and said, well, to be safe, we think we need a bond. We think there's a mandate here for a bond, and their contractor was unable to obtain it because the bond house they contacted, and I don't know who they worked with, said that two things. One, it was a contract that had already been let, and they weren't going to work on interfering with an existing contract, and two, the type of work that was being performed didn't meet the thresholds. And I don't pretend to be a bond expert. I know there are some people waiting to testify with concerns about the bill that I met with the other day. They were surprised when I told them that. But that we hear this from time to time on an increasing basis. In rural Minnesota with these small contractors, it's harder and harder for them to be able to obtain bonds and certainly to be able to afford the bonds. And so the compromise with the A3 amendment is to say, look, as originally drafted, the bill inadvertently covered any MnDOT contract, and that was never our intent. We did not want to start interfering with major state contracts. And so we narrowed the scope dramatically to say, when you're talking about snow, ice, grading, the stuff that everybody agrees is routine maintenance, we're not having problems with contractors going bankrupt, we're not having contractors breaching their agreement, that there should be an exemption. And so that's the main emphasis of the bill. But then the cleanup to say, instead of tying it to a $75,000 fixed dollar amount, to link it to the bid thresholds, those bid thresholds are amended maybe once a decade, that we look at saying what's the proper rate now, what is the proper level based on inflation and public risk. I do want to make it clear this does not remove the authority for a road authority to get a bond at any level. They want to get a performance bond for a $10,000 project, they are perfectly allowed to do so. This simply removes an absolute mandate and creates flexibility both for the local unit at the township level and for the smaller contractors that are out there. That I'll stand for questions.
Any questions? Seeing none. Senator Chamberlain moves that Senate File 1673 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred
Mr.
to
Chairman.
The
Chairman.
Mr. Chair, we do have another testifier. I'm sorry.
Move to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also have another testifier with me as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Beverly Turner. I'm Vice President of Government Relations for Travelers Insurance Companies. We're one of the largest private employers in downtown St. Paul, as well as the largest writer of surety bonds in the state of Minnesota, as well as nationally. And in fact, we do write the types of surety bonds that this legislation covers. And we do provide bonds, we sell bonds for road maintenance in the state of Minnesota. First, I want to thank Senator Carlson for working with us. I really appreciate his willingness to sit down with us and hear our concerns in the bill. And he has made changes that address some of these concerns. Unfortunately, it didn't go far enough in the amendment, and we are still on record as respectfully opposing the bill as it in its current state. Surety bonds provide protection in case the contractor can't perform the contract services required. And we will step in and make sure that those services are performed. In these types of economic times, it's particularly important because we've seen a lot of the contractors that we work with and that we bond have gone out of business. And you don't want to put the taxpayers at risk to have to pay twice for the same service that wasn't performed the first time around. A surety bond, such as Travelers offers also provides pre-screening services for those contractors and for the municipality or the public entity that is contracting, so that in order to secure that bond, they have to be qualified. We pre-screen them for the public entity to assure that they're qualified as much as possible, that we know that they will be able to fulfill the terms of that contract and to pay their subcontractors, which is another piece of this as well. It's not only the taxpayers that are at risk, but it's those subcontractors that are the vendors that subcontract with that main contractor that are also protected under the bond that ultimately could be hurt by not getting paid for either their materials or services under the contract. While we would prefer to see a non-legislative solution to this problem, and we've offered to the Township Association and their members that we would come and help them with education on how to structure these contracts to minimize the risk and so that there would not be a need for the bonds. We see in this business that we do sell bonds on, that there are spring contracts for maintenance divided out from winter contracts for snow and ice removal, as well as annual contracts or simply just dollar amount contracts or hours performed that would eliminate the need for a bond under the requirement in state statute now. And we're more than willing to attend the seminars with the township mutuals that they provide and to help them to understand these other options available them, again, to reduce the risk and eliminate the need for the bond, and that they understand how surety bonds work. I'd also like to, at this time, draw your attention to specific problems that we have with the bill before you. If you'll look at lines 117, 117, and 118, and first of all, we have concerns over creating exemption of a laundry list of exceptions that erodes the purpose of the bill and can always have the danger of setting a precedent of adding on other exceptions later on. Again, what you're doing here is you're placing taxpayer money at risk, and that's, I think, something valuable to consider. Also, we disagree that the under lines 1.21 to 122, that this is just a housekeeping amendment. This amount increases the exemption from a bond requirement 33%. And that's a fairly large policy decision that you're making here by increasing this amount for lessening the amount for a bond. Also, I think it's a unwise policy decision to tie it to the competitive bidding structure. Competitive bidding's purpose is to provide for a public accountability and transparency in government and conducting the government's business and entering contracts. The statute before you is a protection to the taxpayers and the risk and the exposure that a bond eliminates or helps to provide a reduction of that exposure. They're two totally different purposes for these statutes. They shouldn't be linked together. In addition, if you go back to line 1.18, we have concerns over just exactly what similar routine road maintenance means and how wide open that means is and what could be applied under that definition. Thank you. I certainly welcome the opportunity to continue to work with Senator Carlson on this bill. As I said, we do have some very serious concerns about it, and I would be happy to answer any questions. I also have Brent McBeath with me today, who is with Travelers and can help with any technical questions you have about surety bonds.
Thank you. I would have one. How many of these, this category of bond, have you paid out on, say, in the last year in the state of Minnesota?
Category
that this would be impacting?
Category-wise, meaning road maintenance or the size of the project?
Well, the 100,000 and under, I guess.
Well, in the state over the past year, I don't know that I have any hard and fast numbers, but it is more likely that smaller contractors will default than larger contractors, and smaller contractors are generally the types of entities going after contracts of this size.
Mr. Solom, do you know?
Mr. Chair, I do not have any statistics. I can tell you that we are not receiving floods of calls from our members. Matter of fact, I don't know that I've received any saying we've had a contractor breach a contract with us for this type of work. That's why we've narrowly tailored it to the town road issue and taken out the larger issues that were brought to our attention. I can tell you that the handful of times where we've had bonds and other types of public work projects for a major work, the response is usually it's cheaper to get the new contractor than try to collect on the bond with the legal fees and the frustration that they have. I can tell you that as far as safekeeping the tax dollars, obviously local government officials are very concerned about tax dollars. And again, this doesn't remove their authority for bonds. If they feel that there's an issue, they certainly can and will seek the bonds. Nobody's more frugal than the town supervisors that are out there in terms of risk. But they also look at we're paying. I believe I was told when we met the other day that the average bond is about 1% of the contract price. So you're driving up a maintenance contract, $250 for the extra bond costs when there has been no exposure of any significant risk that our folks have encountered, and it has driven contractors out of business, allowing us fewer flexible options to obtain. So we see this bill as simply providing the flexibility and the local governments making that cost-benefit analysis.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for the testifiers or on the bill? Senator Kielash.
Yes. To the point about or other similar routine road maintenance on town roads, what is that? What are similar routine road maintenance? What does that include? Or, I mean, some of it is it's pretty generalized. So you could repair a culvert. What are we talking about?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, traditional road work on a town road, the vast majority being gravel, it would include maybe an extra load of gravel being installed, an extra chloride application for dust control. It is not rebuilding the road. It is not a culvert. Most of the culverts are ditch-type work. That would be a more major risk. If it were to hit the threshold, we would encourage a bond, but again, the local units would decide. Very few of the culvert projects we work on hit 100,000 or hit 75,000, so they're exempt under current law. If I may also just address one other issue that was raised, we do a very good job of advising our members and training them on their options, and if the idea is to say, well, gee, if you just break up the contract, you can circumvent the statute, sort of shows the purpose that we're not seeing the problem. If you can guide them to circumvent the statute, why not just make the statute work?
Further questions? Seeing none, Senator Chamberlain moves that Senate File 1673, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to Commerce. Replaced on general orders. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Next bill on the agenda is Senate File 1668. Senator Chamberlain.
Either one of you can come up first, so everyone can come first.
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Noon, Senator Chamberlain.
Senate File 1668 is related to Met Council in general and light rail planning specifically. I have no amendments for this one. Our objective is to simply bring more accountability and transparency to the Met Council operations, in this case specifically due to the process of rail projects. I personally support wise and effective use of mass transit, rail and bus both, but I do not wish to eliminate either of those, light or heavy rail. I would simply like to get the voice, back to the residents who elected their local officials when these projects come through their communities. Later we'll talk about those briefly. Under current law, there is a process, and my council friends sitting behind me and those advocates will agree that there is a process that by statute that requires the council to go through a series of steps to get the planning, the design, and get to construction of these light rail projects. They'll also tell you that there are citizen groups put together to help deal with these things and bridge the gaps. But in the end, if there is not an agreement reached, if the local unit of government doesn't like it or really doesn't want it, the Met Council will impose a plan upon them, whether they want it or not. Now, my Met Council friends and advocates, again, will say that they haven't had any complaints or real problems with the process, but I would claim that the process and the system the process and the system is simply set up to not allow anyone to break away from that plan. So the city and county folks are simply compelled to, in the end, cooperate, and they realize that in the end is in their best interest. Sum this up, the Met Council is an unelected body. It's composed of 17 members appointed by the governor. The council receives funding from various sources and grants and has the authority to levy taxes. Here's some numbers on the operating budgets, the 2012 operating budget, $780 million. Of that, property tax comprises $77 million. The total rail, that's light and heavy rail, is about $44.5 million. Fares make up for $12.6 million of that expense. That's roughly 28% of the total expense. The capital budget, which includes everything, parks and rail and buses and all that stuff, is about $33.4 billion for the next 6 years. Of that, transitways are $2.5 billion. So this rail stuff and the bus stuff comprise a large, significant amount of the capital expenditure. $1.2 million for Southwest Corridor is planned. $1 billion is the proposed amount for the Bottineau line that would run from about Maple Grove down to North Minneapolis. And $500 million is the estimated cost for the Rush line. I have had some personal experience with the rail lines, the Hiawatha line, the first one to go into town. I lived down in that neighborhood. It destroyed parking. It just transformed the character of that neighborhood. And I had to stop using Hiawatha and go up Cedar because I couldn't get across the street and the traffic would back up. I also grew up in the neighborhoods that the Bottineau line would go through. And Robbinsdale specifically, this is a line like no other line. It will cut through neighborhoods, go down the middle of streets, and there'll be a chain link fence separating homes from these trains. And when we talk about safety, that's a problem as well. So in the end, if they don't want this train to go through their neighborhood and their historic areas, and there are historic areas in Robbinsdale that will transform the character of those neighborhoods, the city cannot do anything about it. It's hard to organize. It's hard to question them. You just can't stop it. The state has little control right now over the cost of light rail and the capital expenditures for those projects. With that, I will end my piece of it, and I'll turn it over to Mr. McCann, and he has some comments.
Good afternoon. My name is Jack McCann. I am the president of the University Avenue Business Association. I'm also a commercial property owner on University Avenue. I got both feet into this when the planning process was introduced to our family and the neighboring properties. That process never really amounted to a firm plan as it was being developed as things went along. So therefore, even as the property owners were objecting to it, the plan was still not finalized, and they kept saying that, oh, we will take your comments into consideration during the planning process. That planning process never really took any of that into account, as every time the next phase came out, it was as if they didn't listen to any of the comments that we had made. As this continued, more and more folks would show up at the meetings just by way of being at the meeting. I can tell you that there just wasn't people there who were for this. It was specifically just folks who were speaking out against the light rail and had all kinds of problems with the design process, problems with the construction phases, and their questions were not being answered, and the effects that were imminent were not being given the proper weight. It did appear that possibly some steps were passed by the Met Council, specifically an economic impact study that was brought to light by a federal case involving the Rondo neighborhoods. There's a federal judge that got involved asking them to revisit that and actually do a economic impact study. That was improperly handled. And we are now in our third request from that same federal judge asking them to do their homework and finish an economic impact study. All the while, this project is being pushed forward. It's been that way for 4 years as I've been doing this. I was even asked by the St. Paul Pioneer Press to write an op-ed specifically relating to the fact that we are having many, many, many meetings. We are doing a lot of talking and a lot of testimony, and no one from the Met Council seems to be listening to any of it. And that was published a couple of years ago. It hasn't changed any. They do seem to ride a little roughshod over some of the rules. And without having more oversight on this entity, I can see this process being spread throughout the transit design, which I've seen. And although Senator Chamberlain talks about $3-point-some billion, my estimates are a lot higher when you see how many different rail lines are proposed. So I think reining this in sooner and trying to get a hold of the powers that can stick this type of situation into any neighborhood, I think it's past due for that.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. McCann. Members, do we have any questions for Mr. McCann? Senator Kelash.
Mr. McCann, because light rail's there, won't your property increase in value as it becomes more popular, more populated? It becomes a source of both residential and businesses as it moves forward. So isn't there a benefit to your commercial properties?
Well, that question has been asked an awful lot. There is a certain benefit for certain people up and down the rail line. My business, a commercial rental business, I'm not a retail business, we have taken a significant hit with the planning process of people not wanting to be around it. I've taken a significant hit during the construction phase. The reduction in the rental rates up and down the avenue because of the vacancy rate being up now at 25%, normally in a corridor this size about 9%. So the depressed numbers I'm talking about on about 300,000 square feet of a couple of dollars a foot is not something I'm going to see back in any time soon. It's been a real problem. It's assumed that this is some glorious thing being dropped off on our doorsteps. It's running people out of business that they stated they would run them out of business. They stated to the Met Council they would have to move. They couldn't last. The economic impact was not fully evaluated properly by the Met Council. And the Donovan, Judge Donovan Frank has asked them now for the third time to do a proper study. The first one related to a highway reconstruction project in Texas. So it's kind of thumbing their nose at the whole process to just throw something down on paper, check a box, and move on. Yes, the economic benefit is going to be there. It's ripe for redevelopment. But for all the folks that have been there for years and years, I've invested 22 years and upwards of $12 million in the place, and it's not a good return on investment currently. It will be. This train might run in 2014. I want to be around for that. I know a lot of my neighbors who aren't, and it hasn't been evaluated properly.
Any other questions for Mr. McCann? With that, we'll move on to our next testifier. Do we have Elma Sanders?
Yes.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Elma Sanders. I live in Robbinsdale. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thanks for having me here today. I first became aware of the Northwest Route through a mailing from Robbinsdale, and then I did attend a Robbinsdale City scoping meeting. And in talking with the other attendees there, it seemed like the overriding concern there was the noise and vibration of the potential of it through the neighborhoods that it would affect. So when that was discussed, what we were told was that light rail would increase property values. But in looking at the proposed routes being run, it looked like it was primarily through working class neighborhoods, not necessarily the upper class ones. So I had some concerns about that because I thought, well, if there's a bump in property values, why wouldn't they run this through the upper class neighborhoods? So I guess I'm not drinking that Kool-Aid. So I haven't thought about this some more. I actually did write a response back to the person, I forget his name now, but I did write a response back of my concerns. And then I also have additional concerns about what this is going to do to the traffic on Broadway Avenue, because what I've been told is that the route, the tracks will run parallel to the existing freight route that runs alongside Broadway Avenue. It will cross over Broadway a few blocks, actually, from where I live in that particular neighborhood. So during rush hour, every 5 or 10 minutes, we're going to be looking at the gates coming down and the ding-ding. And I think most of us would not want that in our neighborhood. So additionally, in addition to that, the noise factor, the backup of the traffic, we already have a freight route that runs a little bit further up towards Bass Lake Road that I tend to get caught in just in my normal travels once or twice a week. That one runs a lot more frequently. So between the two routes, I think we're looking at almost rendering Broadway Avenue as not a drivable route. So I have a lot of concerns about that being usable once this becomes established. So I do believe that these decisions should be placed in the hands of our elected officials who would then, you know, carry out what the will of the people is. So that's pretty much it, I guess.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Sanders. Members, do we have any questions for the testifier? With that, we'll move on. I see that Eva Ng has joined us. Will you please announce your name for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Eva Ng, and I'm a resident of St. Paul. I don't own any property along University Avenue, so I have no dog in the fight. However, I am president of Capital City Business Council, which represents about 100 businesses, and about 50 of those have some sort of business near or on University Avenue, and they were heavily impacted. I became aware of the issues with the light rail beginning in the year 2009 when I was running for office in St. Paul to become mayor. I tell you what, the chamber was so excited to see me, they grabbed me with both hands on the way in. But the moment I said I was against light rail, they sent me out without any handshakes. So, so I knew where everybody stood at that moment. But, you know, you know, for me, it's about representing the people and doing the right things and doing the right things right. When I saw this light rail being done, I tell you, I came from 30 years of serving in Fortune 100 companies to small businesses, you know, $1 million a year type businesses. So I seeing the business and decision-making process, I have never, ever seen anything like this, okay? Less than sound judgment was made all the way through this process. When you have a $900 million to $1 billion project, you would want to make sure that there's cost-effectiveness involved. The cost-effectiveness index never met the federal guidelines. So in January of 2010, the Met Council actually went to the Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood, and asked him to waive the cost-effectiveness index. And he actually did it, which is just shocking to me. You know, this is a capital project, and there's no cost-effectiveness or, you know, benefit over cost analysis done. There was an 800-page document put together, and we went through Capital City Business Council and three of his board members, sat in the room for a weekend, went through all 800 pages, not a single dollar sign in that entire book. We're saying, what's going on here? How could you make decisions without knowing what we're paying for? And why are we paying for it? And whether it will benefit the citizens going forward? And we were just amazed at how these decisions were made. Now, this is what happened. They said, in the paper, it says, by 2020, we should expect about 40,000 people to be served by this light rail. This is Central Corridor Light Rail. And then they said, well, those numbers are really not right. So let's do this. The Met Council decided to project out 10 more years. But and then this is on their website, and I found it again last night. By 2030, we might expect about 42,000 people to be riding this light rail. Okay? Let's say that we spend $1 billion building it. It's going to be about 40% cost overruns, which is basically what they're telling us to expect. And then you got some litigation, you got some business loss mitigation money that you got to put in, you know, and then things that you didn't think about. Okay, say about $2 billion to build this thing, to serve about 40,000 people. You're talking about $50,000 of benefits to each person. I would say buy them an SUV and give them a gas card. Honestly, this is silly.
The environment.
And then on top of that, there was misbehavior. For people who actually spoke up against this light rail, they get their properties blocked up first. So they saw it as soft intimidation. When it was time for us to come and testify in front of the Senate, in front of the House, guess what? A lot of these businesses who are being, well, quote unquote, punished, you know, don't want to come up and say anything. They don't want any more consequences. And that's happening. That's misbehavior, you guys. And then there's anarchy. Anarchy. When do you ever issue a contract without knowing there's money for it? When we came to testify in a little conference room near here, we were told that the horses were not really out of the barn yet, but they're about three-quarters out of the barn. That means contracts were issued before matching funding from the federal government ever came. Whoever has authority to issue contracts and when there's no money in the till? No business would ever do that. I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't write a check without knowing that that money is going to be there when somebody goes and cash that check. But yet the Met Council is allowed to do this. On top of that, it's whatever they say they wanted to spend. It's taxation without representation. It's taking our state constitution, it's taking our federal constitution and just shredding it right there in front of our faces. And we're putting up with this. Like I said, I have no dog in the fight, but it's the principle. This is the United States of America. We're governed by laws. We're governed by simple principles. But yet, we're allowing somebody to write contracts without any kind of authorization, without any kind of money in the till, without any kind of recourse. I asked, well, you know, when we issue these contracts, don't we have contingencies in them? Like if the money wasn't there, if the money wasn't approved, well, we'd be holding the bag for $500 million. Well, as far as they know, there were no contingencies. Who do you know can write contracts like this and wouldn't get fired? And then there were outright lies. Outright lies. Like Jack McCann is telling you, heavily impacted. We have businesses that were impacted 24% in the first 2 months of construction. We studied Seattle. Those lines are looking at 40 to 60% impact depending on the size of the business and the type of business. Yet in the EIS, the environmental impact statement, it says, oh, we think they're going to be affected by 2%. This is printed.
Ms. Singh, I hate to interrupt, but we are on kind of a tight schedule here. We want to keep moving, so if you could move to wrapping up, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you so much. You got me going. I mean, somebody's got to tell you what's going on. You know, I just never seen anything like this. So they're saying 2% impact? That's not true. So, and then they also said that they had nearly no opposition. I will tell you that Capital City Business Council commissioned a study, and we actually knocked on the doors of nearly 1,000 businesses. 800 of them replied to us and says, most of them, two-thirds of them says, no, they don't want the light rail at all. It makes no sense. And one-third of them, who actually are not on the first floor, who don't depend on the storefront, who are more like professional spaces, they would say that, well, it's okay to have it here, provided that our parking is not going to be messed with. And yet none of these were reflected. None of these comments were reflected in their EIS. So the wrap-up is, while this Senate file 1668 is a little weak going forward, it doesn't include, you know, citizen groups and business groups that are affected. Maybe that type of phrasing should be in there. You know, that if you're a citizen group or you're a business group that's affected, you should have a say. You know, Jack McCann's group should have a say. So that if you include that, we're all for it. Going forward, I've canvassed my board, and they are all in favor of it. Thank you so much, and I wrap up.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Singh. Do we have any questions for the testifiers, members? Moving on, would anyone else like to speak for or against Senate File 1668?
I don't think there's any more.
With all due respect, Senator Chamberlain, we do still need to provide the opportunity.
Thank you.
I had a feeling Mr. Shetman would have something to say about this. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Shetman. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetman. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. I also have Mark Furman, who's our Deputy General Manager at Metro Transit, who's our Director of Rail Projects at the Council, here as well. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak to Senate File 1668. And I think it's important to speak to the bill. I know that there's been a lot of discussion and a lot of comments about the activities that the council and the counties in the city of St. Paul, and the city of Minneapolis move forward with as we built the Central Corridor line and work that we did in the Hiawatha line as well. But I'd like to speak to the bill. We can certainly be happy to come back and have another conversation about the comments that were made about the public process that went through. I can assure you that there was a public process that was held in order to make those decisions. These discussions go well back before the previous testifiers' comments were made about not knowing anything about this prior to 2009. That is simply not the truth. These hearings have gone on for many, many, many years. There were also public hearings that were held. And if this will help at all, we also have a community advisory committee that participates as part of the planning group for the Central Corridor line. But I'll speak to the bill. The bill speaks to additional municipal consent language. And Senator Chamberlain asked me to go late here, and I'm going to. I think that what this bill does is redundant with what we have in place today. We do have a municipal consent from the cities that are along the line. I'm going to let Mr. Furman speak to it, but I understand Senator Chamberlain's what he's trying to do here. What I'm saying is that we already have those processes in place in order to ensure that the cities are heard from, and we need their support prior to moving forward with these projects anyway. And Mr. Furman can cover that.
Thank you, Mr. Shutna. Mr. Furman, please introduce your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark Furman, Deputy General Manager with Metro Transit, and I oversee the light rail program for Met Transit and Met Council. I would like to say that the existing statute, as we have applied it successfully on the Hiawatha LRT, North Star Commuter Rail, and Central Corridor light rail projects, has been very effective. It has promoted complete transparency for the Met Council as we advance these projects forward through the design and engineering phase. The current law calls for the project sponsor, we at Met Council, to work with the local jurisdictions, cities, and counties to develop those plans and then present them formally to the locals at 30% preliminary engineering, preliminary design. And at that point in the statutory process, we request municipal consent. If there is objection, concern stated by those local governments, we work through that and make adjustments as necessary to ultimately secure the municipal consent necessary. The reality, Mr. Chair and members, is that without receipt of municipal consent, the project cannot proceed. We cannot go back to those cities or counties and go to their public works office and pull a construction permit without that municipal consent being in place. So we believe the current law in effect now for over a dozen years is effective, promotes transparency, and does provide the necessary checks and balances for these projects as they go through the design development phase.
Thank you, Mr. Furman. Members, do we have any questions for the testifiers? Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you. Mr. Furman and Mr. Shetland, I've heard from several sources a number of different times that the project was started before it really had the federal funding. Is that true, or is that a misnomer?
I'll let you speak to that.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Furman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Vandeveer, the project evolution on these LRT projects is multi-years, and we go through a very exhaustive and extensive review process with the federal government. For the Central Corridor project, I'll cite that as the most current example. We went through our preliminary engineering, completed that successfully with the municipal consent I mentioned, final design, and then finalized our design and made our application for the federal funding at that time in 2010. In later 2010, FTA then gave us the green light that it was supporting the project but had to submit the project for final review through the Secretary's office and the mandatory 60-day courtesy congressional review. It was during that time, after FTA stated their approval, but before they signed the grant agreement, that we began some initial utility relocation and initial construction prior to the formal execution of the full funding grant agreement.
So, Mr. Furman, were you spending money prior to having the federal before the federal government was obligated to pay a share of the project? Is that a yes or a no?
Mr. Chair and
Mr.
Senator,
Furman.
Yes, we spent money, local money for preliminary engineering, local money for final design, and some local money for construction prior to execution of the full funding grant in April of 2011.
Well, Mr. Furman, let me put it this way. Would the federal government have been obligated to pay at the point where you began construction? Were they then obligated to pay their share?
Mr. Furman?
Mr. Chair and Senator, they were not contractually obligated to pay their share until execution of the contract in April of last year.
So you did begin construction without Senator obligation Mindy. From this federal government to pay their share, yes or no?
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, and I'd like to put that in some context. The Central Corridor project is the seventh project of this nature that I've worked on in my career, from the Washington, D.C. area to Minnesota. And the standard practice of any of these projects nationally is whereby once the federal government says everything is in order, we are a financial partner with you, you can begin some early limited construction work while you await full execution of the contract. And that's exactly what we did for Central Corridor.
Yep. Mr. Furman, could you give us some examples of those other projects and where they were located?
The other projects, in addition to the projects in Minnesota, have been three heavy rail projects for the Washington, D.C. Metro. The Blue Line and Orange Line are the projects I worked on in Virginia, and the first commuter rail line in Virginia called the Northern Virginia Railway Express.
Mm-mm. Mr. Shitton.
Mr. Chair, thank you again. What I'd also like to add is that when we move forward with this, we did this with the blessing of the Pawlenty administration. Again, as Mr. Furman mentions, we go through this process when we were when we didn't have that in hand. We did use these letters of no prejudice in order to move forward to keep the project on time and on budget, and that allowed us to be able to move that work forward in order to deliver it on time. It was a process and a decision that was made by the previous council and the previous administration, and it is our role in order to make that decision, and the governor's office decided that that was the appropriate way to move forward, and we did, and we believe it's the right decision, and the line is being built. We received the full funding grant agreement, which guaranteed the federal share, the 50% federal share, and we're able to deliver that project and build it like we're doing right now.
Mr. Shittenden, how much of that partial funding do you feel helped get the final funding for the project? I mean, I think what you're hearing discussed today is that we kind of get down this path and then we get to a point of no return. And I think that's kind of what we're attempting to deal with here, where you don't have partial funding and that creates a need to finish it.
Right. Mr. Chair and members, I don't know, there's Senator Roebling. Senator Roebling has asked this question of us in the past as well. I think it is a good question. How we move forward with these projects is that we move forward in phases. When the project comes to the Metropolitan Council, it's at the preliminary engineering phase. There are a number of phases that take care at the local level prior to that, and then we go from preliminary engineering to final design to construction. And the way that these projects move forward is that we don't receive the federal funds for this until after the final design is done. So it's the local responsibility to front-end that money for those two phases, and then the federal government money comes in and it makes everything the split between the 10% from the state, the 10% from the Regional Rail Authority, and the 30% from the County Transit Improvement Board. So up until that point, when we get the full funding grant agreement, the state is spending roughly the 20%, and the Regional Rail Authority is spending 20%. And the CTIB is paying 60% of that funds, of those funds. So the risk to the state is really 20%, not the total amount. And we also know that as we go through preliminary engineering to final design, there has never been a project that hasn't been moved into final design that has not received a full funding grant agreement. So that is why decisions are made, not just in the metropolitan area here, but with these new starts types of projects in order to move these projects along.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what I thought I understood is that right now you believe that there is a significant amount of local control, because the cities that you're passing through with these lines would not give you a permit if they did not approve of the project.
Mm-hmm.
And I am a little conflicted on this, because I'm like at the end of the rail. And so if a And I don't know if this, when or if this will ever happen, but I've seen it with the Dan Patch line, in that we can't even talk about it because certain communities don't like the idea of that line going along the route that was originally proposed. So that means that Scott County doesn't really have an option to even think or talk. We can't even talk about it. I'm talking about it because I'm a senator, but you aren't supposed to, Mr. Shetnin. So staff is not supposed to talk about this. That currently, because of that, and legislation that has been passed, we are kind of out of the loop because other communities have said that they don't want that discussed or ever developed. And so I am kind of conflicted because some community, and it could be a small community, some community as small as Lilydale, for example, could stop the next community from getting a project. And this happens with roads, too. And we have the same local requirement for roads. And I remember some bad things that have happened because of that. When we were trying to build the Bloomington Ferry Bridge and 169, Eden Prairie didn't want a freeway through their community. So they required, as part of their local agreement to give permission for that to come through, that there had to be all these stoplights along there. Those stoplights were the worst idea that ever happened, and we have been paying millions and millions and millions to get them out because they have clogged up traffic so bad along that route. But that was because there was a local demand that be done because they didn't think they wanted a freeway through. And so it has its good points and its bad. I like communities being able to negotiate some, but whether or not they can actually hold up a huge project, whether it's a highway project or a rail project, is a little bit of a concern for me. I do want them to be able to voice their concerns and address as many of the concerns of their residents as possible, but I want it to be reasonable, and I don't know how to guarantee that.
Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, couple things. Mr. Shetland had mentioned redundant, and I'm going to say something that doesn't probably happen often in committees, is that to address the redundancy and without consent issue from Mr. Furman, if you can show me somewhere in this statute book where it says that local communities can eventually deny or have leverage and prevent this mandate from coming through their city, I would gladly withdraw this, but... is there a statute in this somewhere that says that local officials have final authority to vote for these things and turn them down? I'm with Senator Roebling. As I said in my opening statement, I'm for mass transit and light rail, but right now the billions of dollars on the books of capital projects and the operating costs, there is literally no way that the Senate right now or the legislature can stop these projects. And we have to find a way to mitigate that leverage and the power of the Met Council. So if we can find a way to mitigate and leverage that power of the council and put it under the purview of the legislature, I'd be happy to do that. But right now, they're building these billion-dollar projects out into the future, and there's no way right now with current statute we can stop it.
None. Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chamberlain, I guess, you know, the whole idea behind having a regional entity to try to develop transit roads and bus service and light rail is so that the region is benefited from it. If we, as Senator Roebling suggests, allow a local community to say, to have the veto authority over this without any... any other means of getting this done, how in the world can we possibly have a competitive metropolitan area in the state of Minnesota without some kind of transit? We're already decades behind a lot of other states, and it's hurting our business climate. And as you know, the chamber is one that is heavily promoting these light rail projects because they need to get their folks to and from work. So what I and one of the Mr. Ferber or whoever could, but what I get out of your bill is that after the Met Council has done the work of saying here's where we'd like it to go and working with the local units of government, there's still the possibility that a community could change elected officials and throw that agreement out and. You know, millions and millions of dollars in work would be thrown out the window because some community objects to having a transit system go by when it's a benefit to the whole community. Well, so that, you know, Richfield can't stop Senator Roebling from getting transit out to her neck of the woods.
Senator Chamberlain.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Senator Kielash, you know, I don't disagree with some sort of metropolitan level of governance and planning, but and I'm perfectly willing to listen to reasonable explanations and solutions that bring oversight back to the Metropolitan Council. They have a budget as big as any department in this state, besides HHS. But we simply need to bring – the legislature has the responsibility to bring oversight. So I agree with some level of metropolitan planning and ability to do that. I certainly do. But we need to have – I think it's reasonable to say we need to have some sort of oversight and control over that process, whether the legislature does that or if we do it locally. You mentioned, secondly, the regional benefit. I would argue that there are many regions outside the 694 loop that say they're not getting the benefit from the Met Council regional planning, and it's severely dampening their ability to grow economically. So I don't disagree with your premise. I do agree with that thing, but I think we need to bring some reasonable measure of oversight to the Met Council. They have no we have no leverage right now. Thank you.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you. Mr. Furman or Mr. Shetnin, can the Met Council grant a construction permit for a city? Can they bypass the city granting a construction permit and begin construction of a light rail line without that construction permit from a city?
Mr. Chair and
Mr.
Senator
Furman.
Sieben, no. We cannot construct in a local city or county without the necessary construction permit.
So, Senator Chamberlain,
Senator Sieben,
what's your response to that? I mean, it sounds like your bill is unnecessary, and it maybe just if you're bringing your bill forward to try to make some more points about how you want there to be a more collaborative process with communities and the Metropolitan Council. Your point, but I'm just wondering what your response is.
Senator Chamberlain.
Well, Senator, Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, when the cities, again, there's nothing, I have asked the two gentlemen to show me in statute and code where the cities are allowed to deny a permit or they're allowed to say no to the project. Once the final design plan is done, in the statute here says the council review of the commission of the sub 7, the council must review the plans for consistency with the benefit development's guide and approve the plan. And I have not been shown, has anybody been shown in statute or code where the council or the council where that local folks must not issue a permit or that they have the ability to deny that permit. And nobody has answered that. Council, staff council, and I have been through this. And if I'm mistaken, we can get rid of this. But nobody's been able to tell me that. And with the testifiers and the people I've talked to in the past, it's easy for them to say, well, they can't begin construction without a permit. Nothing in here says the city can deny them the permit.
Oh, my God.
All I'm asking is for the cities to have a little more reasonable input.
Senator Chamberlain will ask Ms. Dangle to see if she can take a run at that question.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator Chamberlain, I'm not aware of anything that would say exactly what you're looking for either. Cities do have to grant the permits, but it's my understanding that At least with some types of permits, cities can't deny a permit just because they don't like a project. It's if they meet the requirements of the ordinance or the statute, sometimes they do have to grant the permit whether they like it or not. I don't have the statutory sites for that. I don't have a lot of good examples for you right now. If that's something that you would like or the committee would like, I could certainly get that to you later.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Senator Limerick. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Senator Chamberlain, is it your intent that a local municipality would be able to stop a rail system from being built, just that if it's on the route? I'm hearing a little bit of mixed. Is that your intent, that that if you have 10 local municipalities along a rail line and one would say they don't want it, that would not allow the entire rail line?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Chamberlain.
Senators McGuire. The way the bill is written, that is the intent at this time. All bills start and they can be changed and amended along the way, but that is the intent of this bill, to say to the Met Council that the citizens that elect our local officials and live in a particular community who 3 years ago did not plan that, did not believe a train was going to come down the middle of their street and put a chain link fence up between them and their street and their sidewalk, that they should have the ability to say, wait a minute. So the private rail line couldn't do that. You can't drop an airport in the middle of a city. So just looking for some reasonable oversight and controls. And I'm not saying that we can prevent or should stop all rail projects. I'm just saying that the cities and the residents should have some local authority.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But you understand, Senator Chamberlain, that this would do that.
You just told me
that's not your intent, but so, Senator, this would most likely stop some of this from happening if you had one.
Mr. Chair, and Senator McGuire, I'll say it again. That is the intent of the bill. I would like to see rails built, but I also want it done responsibly and reasonably with some representation from the local residents. And right now, that's not the case.
No, Mr. Chairman.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Chamberlain. If this were bill were to say roads instead of light rail lines, if you had a community where they wanted to put a road by it, would you feel the same way, that a community couldn't have a road by it?
Communities, there
Senator
is.
Chamberlain.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Senator McGuire, communities and eminent domain issues go on now. And there's when they're displaced, they get payment, and there's quite a lot of, some cities are chartered, so they have a lot of trouble getting roads and infrastructure taken care of. They have to go through a process. It's very very representative. And again, I'm not against rail or roads, but I'd like to see, when they put a road somewhere, though, Senator McGuire, they go through the DOT, which is approved by the legislature, approved by you and all of us here, to make sure that's appropriate and that's where it should go and that the people are satisfied and that their property is taken, it's going to be paid for, and they'll be duly compensated. But with the light rail, we don't have that oversight.
Senator Chamberlain, I do believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Dangle, that we do have municipal approval for roads currently in statute, do we not?
Mr. Chair, that used to be the case sometime maybe 10 years ago. They changed that, and I believe something to the effect of if the city and the DOT don't agree on the project, there is some appeals process that settles the matter, but it's no longer up to the cities.
Okay. So, Senator McGuire. Thank you, Mr. McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more question then. Senator Chamberlain, so if you're interested mainly in that there be a process, perhaps your bill could put in more of a process. I've already heard from the Met Council that there is a process. I understand there's an extensive public process, but maybe you could work on making sure that there's a public input process. But telling cities that they would have the veto power over a regional line, I think, is a little maybe more, it's more drastic than you might want to go, because we do want some regional planning going on. But if you want the municipalities to have a greater say, I expect we could draft a bill that would say that.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding from the testimony that we had from Mr. Furman is that, both of you actually, that 30% of the project has been the preliminary planning and design have been done before you begin this process? Is that correct?
Mr. Furman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Eaton, I'll be a little bit more clear than I was previously. We have countless, in fact, hundreds of public meetings with the neighboring businesses and neighborhoods from the time that design begins, at the zero design point, all the way through the 30%, and it's at that design point that we seek the municipal consent. Design will continue after we receive municipal consent to make the final design plans, but really from the ground up we have that that political or policy dialogue and public dialogue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you. Well, I guess what my point is that you would incur a large amount of cost developing that first 30% before you had authorization. Is that not true? I mean, I can't imagine why you would start a project with that kind of uncertainty if any municipality could stop it.
Senator Chamberlain.
No, I'll take it, but we'll defer to Mr. Furman in a minute.
Mr. Furman.
Again, back to Senator McGuire and to Senator Eaton, I think we could develop a process that would be more responsive to citizens, and if we had a process, say this was the rule now, the Met Council would not commit 30% of their resources in. Right now they can commit 30% of their resources because they know eventually they're going to get what they want because nobody can stop it. Show me a light rail project that's been stopped.
Senator Chamberlain, this is on the way to transportation, theoretically.
Yeah.
You could work on maybe copying the route or something else, possibly. But Senator Kalish, did you have a...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chamberlain, Senator Chamberlain, it's... Why would we want to? This whole process has been a level of engagement with the community, deciding where the line will go that best suits the needs of the community. The whole process moves along. Is when you get to the construction phase, and yes, there's disruption in people's lives during that construction phase, that it becomes much more of an issue and much more visible to the folks that are affected by it. But the process has started way before then. If we say we want this project to say, now the neighbors object to the university central quarter line and we should stop this project, well, what about the millions and millions of dollars and time and energy and approvals and what that the taxpayers have paid already? I mean, that's what you're kind of saying, I think, with your bill here, is that at any step along the way, the community can say we object to that line, withdraw our approval of it, and stop this project, which is just, a veto of an incredible amount of public investment in this, not just by the local community that's affected, but by the whole region.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kalish, I'm sorry.
There's a lot of people in this room that testify that process we're praising here today just does not work and is broken. And so I think that's what Senator Chamberlain is trying to address. Yes, Senator Kalish.
Mr. Chair, it's where do they come into the process? Did they start 9 years ago when the initial public testimony was being taken, or did they start when the line was actually the bulldozers were coming down the street? So,
Senator Kalish, I think the city of St. Paul was there the whole time.
And approved it, Mr. Chair. And approved it, right?
No. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And with respect to Senator Kalish's comments, I think we need to be treating roads and rail completely differently. They are two very, very different things. We have a road system in place right now which services a huge number of constituents versus the ridership levels that we're seeing on some of these rail lines. And Senator Kalish, you talk about being able to be involved in the process, but I think you'd be hard-pressed to go out into the constituency and ask folks if they feel like they're informed and like they know very well when these things are going on and these meetings take place. And I know as a whole, we attempt to get notifications out there and get folks involved. But with respect, it's not until that construction starts, it's not until some of that awareness is really just out in front that they have a chance to participate or know that they should participate in that process. And I think that's what we're addressing here, is the fact that by the time they know, this thing is already so far down the path that they don't have a chance to turn it back. We have preliminary engineering done. We have financing that's lined up. We have contingent federal dollars that are, you know, we're waiting to come in if we meet these certain thresholds. I think that speaks to the heart of this bill. And I think you're talking about two very different things. So, I mean, with respect, Senator Chamberlain, I hope you don't try and copy what we try and do with our roadways. I think you're talking about very, very different groups of people and numbers of people that utilize that.
Mr. Shetland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Cruz, I'd like to explain that when these projects start, they start at the local level. It's through the regional rail authorities, the cities, the counties. They bring these processes. They do the feasibility studies. They do the alternatives analysis. All of those are done in a public setting. These projects don't come to the council until they hit the preliminary engineering stage. So I'd like to say to you that the public, the folks who represent those folks, have numerous opportunities to participate in it. Once it gets to the council, we've got business advisory committees, we've got community advisory committees that participate all through the preliminary design and final design project. So I have to respectfully disagree with how you're explaining that.
Hey, Senator Cruz, and then we're going to get ready to wrap it up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and just a quick response to that. I know that Senator Sieben will probably disagree with me on this one, but I know for a fact in dealing with an issue up in my area with the Mississippi critical area and the rulemaking process that went on with that type of the same type of process you're talking about here, that doesn't work. These folks are not informed. They don't get brought to the table until it's too late. So even, I mean, yes, was the city aware of it? Was there work done? Did you have public hearings and things before it went to the municipal level? Potentially, sure, that happens. But it's not about whether you have done those things. It's about how well-informed the constituents are that these are going on.
Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, again, this is at the local level that you're talking about, and that does not fall on the responsibility of what the council is doing when it comes to the preliminary engineering phase of this. That issue is left to the public, through the municipalities, through the regional rail authorities, through the counties, in order to conduct that. So, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but where you're pointing that is not reflected in what is being proposed in this bill. I'm sorry. I probably need to come sit down and talk to you and explain that to you, and I apologize. I just think that we need to probably have a conversation about it. And then regarding rulemaking, as the council has no rulemaking authority.
Further, does anyone else care to testify for or against NFIL 1668? Any further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Chamberlain moves that Senate file of 1668 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Transportation. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
No. No. Motion prevails.
Division.
Division.
Division's been called. All those in favor, Senate file 1668 passing and being sent to transportation, raise your hands.
Oh, are we deadlocked? One, two, three, four.
Oh, that's five. I forgot two.
Adam? Not that many. All those opposed, raise your hand. It being 5 ayes and 5 nays, the bill is not passed. Bill on the agenda is Senate File 1667. Senate Chamberlain.
still have a week.
All the process, Roger.
Have a bad week.
Good fight.
Have a bad week.
Senator Chamberlain moves Senate File 1667. Senator Chamberlain, to your bill.
Missing a couple folks.
Hey, Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another Met Council issue could end up in a tie. I have an amendment, an author's amendment, maybe we want to get to first.
Okay.
The one.
Yeah.
We have.
That's generally how
the A1 amendment. Everyone have the A1 amendment? Senator Chamberlain moves the A1 amendment for any discussion. Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Amendment's adopted. To your bill, Senator Chamberlain.
Mr. Chair and members, this piece relates to the Metropolitan Council's comprehensive development guide and their local unit of governance comprehensive plan. There are three parts essentially to this thing. It's interrelated. Our intent is not to get rid of the comprehensive plan or the system plans or the development guide. Again, we want to give some local authority back to elected officials at the local level. Currently, local officials are required to make comprehensive plans by statute. Comprehensive plans are supposed to agree with or align with the comprehensive development guide put out by the Metropolitan Council. And part of that plan, comprehensive plan, it also contains the system plans. Now, system plans are simply relate to mainly wastewater systems, transportation, and the regional park areas. So, what we did in this piece of legislation was make the cities will still do the local unit of government will still do their comp plans. But they are not obligated to take the recommendations and follow the recommendations of the Comprehensive Development Guide that the Met Council puts out. However, they will still be required to follow the system plans, which requires the wastewater treatment and the transit piece. So what in essence this does, it gives the local governing units like Councilman Rozier more flexibility to decide what they want to do with their property, how they want to develop the city, the amount of green space, commercial, industrial, the density of the property, and the residential units. So, again, comprehensive plans are for the local unit of government. They stay in place. The Comprehensive Development Guide by the Met Council stays in force. The system plans are still there. We're just saying that the comprehensive plans and the local unit of government do not have to take, adopt, and be mandated by the development guide. If you understand that, we can move on, Mr. Chair. And this is Councilman Rozier. I'd like him to say a few words. He's had some experience with these plans, and he can share some experience.
Okay.
Yes,
state your name for the tape, please. And
yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. My name is Dave Rozier. I'm a city council member from Lionel Lakes in my second term. I'm also a local business owner, and I own property in both Anoka and in Ramsey County. So I'm very familiar being a business owner and owning commercial properties. I'm very familiar with the Met Council whacking and sacking us on a regular basis with regards to water and sewer. What I see from my vantage point as a city councilperson is that really what we've got is an issue of taxation without representation. We have a a lot of taxes going on our property owners. We've got a, seems like we have a lot of overlapping of powers. We have cities that have economic development authorities, EDAs, and I see that the Met Council is also pushing into this area, also doing a lot of demonstration projects as well. I have to say I have gotten some education about the Met Council. I've learned a new term called forgivable loans. I've never understood that term before. I, being from Chicago, I guess I would originally I would call that a bribe, but unique terminology here. I'm not sure where the authority to give that money away comes from, but I just want to say that we've got a, it seems to me, unchecked and a growing power that seems to be costing the city. We've got a lot of time and cost in many of these plans. Our 2030 comp plan has taken several years. It's been back and forth to the Met Council because of wording issues. Then a lot of things that have been kind of arbitrary. Some of the language and the densities and exactly where they're coming from. There seems to be a little bit of a hidden agenda that's in there. This has caused a lot of delays to developers to be able to develop properties, and that of course costs them money, and some of them aren't in business today because of those delays. It seems that there's a real push for density, and it's kind of a cookie-cutter approach that they want higher density. Now, I used to live in St. Paul and moved out to Lionel Lakes because I wanted lesser density. There seems to be a push to make us more like Europe, and if I wanted to live in Europe, I guess I'd move there. What I see is that being reelected here and talking to my constituents is that our people, our residents, don't want the high density and the issues that come with that. They like having their large lots. They like being able to have their well and their septic fields as well. And I think that the city representatives, those of us who are elected by the residents, have a better handle on what it is that our residents want as far as that density. I also see that the Met Council is takes land out of tax productions for us with park and rides in some pretty expensive real estate that would be out there normally. So that's an issue for the city as well, just that they taking money out of our tax rolls. It also seems that the Met Council is staffed by people, well, they aren't elected, they're appointed, and several of them have been maybe elected officials in the past and maybe have lost those jobs. Maybe those thinkings is what got them unelected in the first place. So I just want to close in saying that I believe that cities have rights, like states' rights. I think that we're sovereign in that regard, that I think the cities are in the best to inform the Met Council on what the growth is going to be and what we need, as opposed to the Met Council telling us that we need to be more like Minneapolis and St. Paul. Thank you.
Senator Chamberlain.
I have no other testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Any questions, Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Chamberlain, could you... We're on Senate File 1667, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And could you explain the reviser's instructions on page 3, lines 14 through 27?
Page 3. Oh, yes, Mr. Chair. Senator Limmer, you're referring to the... what column A is, or column B are, is a purpose statement at the beginning of the chapter. And what it's replaced with are just the definitions. So 473851 is simply a some purpose statement at the beginning of the chapter. And then just replaces that with those definitions. 473852 falls right below that, and those are the definitions.
Okay. Anyone else care to testify for or against Senate File 1667?
Mr. Chairman, one other question.
Senator Limmer.
The repealer, Senator Chamberlain, on line 328, 29.
Yes.
What is the repealer? Could you explain
the repealer? Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer. The repealer is on page, the next page, and that's the purpose statement, finding a purpose of the legislative intent for the comp plans. And Met Council.
Senator or Mr. Shetland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Judd Shetland, the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to Senate File 1667. The Metropolitan Development Guide that's being amended by this bill is the Council's long-term guiding overarching planning framework and vision for the Metropolitan Region. The systems plans are developed separately, but they are like chapters to the Metropolitan Regional Development Guide and are directed under separate statutes. What this bill does, it makes the Metropolitan Development Guide advisory in nature by stating that no local governmental unit shall be required to comply or conform with that guide. But existing statutes exist that require the Council systems plans to conform to the Metropolitan Development Guide and require that local comprehensive plans conform to those systems plans. So we believe that those are in conflict at this point. The bill also repeals, as Senator Limmer just pointed out, the legislative findings and purpose, which contained the basis for the Metropolitan Land Planning Act, which is not repealed in this legislation. The Council supports these findings and purpose because the problems of urbanization and development transcends local government boundaries, and there's a need for the adoption of coordinated plans to ensure that coordinated, orderly, and economic development of our region takes place, and that is right in the findings and purpose. Senate File 1667 also proposes to remove the Council's authority to determine the compatibility with adjacent community plans and removes the Council's authority to review and comment on their consistency with the Council plans, but then later in the bill it rewrites that language to do similar things, but only in advisory sense. The amendment changes the shall to may, but does not change the way we review those plans in regard to today. We only do those reviews as advisory today. I know the language says shall, but the Council only does that in advisory today, so that is something that Senator Chamberlain and I can speak about. The bill does not remove the Council's authority to review local plans for their conformity to Metropolitan Systems plans, as Senator Chamberlain mentioned, or the Council's authority to require plan modifications. And that is where we also find ourselves in conflict with this bill, with current statutes, because the Land Planning Act and the Metropolitan Development Guide work together. So we believe that this bill does have conflicts, and it's ambiguous in a couple other places how we were to interpret those conflicts. So I need to state that the Council supports both the Land Planning Act. We support the Metropolitan Development Guide the way it stands, and we believe that they're essential to the coordinated, orderly, and economic development of the metropolitan area. And for those reasons, the Council does not support this bill. So thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Ms. Nauman?
Yeah.
Senator Kalish.
I'm just going to Mr. Shetter, you didn't mention the elimination of your oversight of the regional open space.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kalish, I appreciate that. This is a new one, this amendment. Yeah. We weren't prepared for that. What it does, it changes significantly the way that the Council works with the 10 implementing agencies throughout the region. We wouldn't do the planning. We also are the conduit for the state funds to flow through to those parks agencies. I'm not sure how the implementing agencies would feel about that. I know that the Council opposes it. Complete.
Thank you.
Ms. Nauman.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to comment today. My name is Patricia Nauman, and I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. We're an organization that is member-based, and we represent cities in the 7-county metropolitan area at both the legislature and Met Council. And we're essentially the city watchdog of the Metropolitan Council. So we take a very keen interest in everything that they do, and so appreciate the interest in the regional form of government. We have a very diverse member set of cities, so a very diverse set of opinions about the Metropolitan Council. But I did want to point out today that we did have a recent task force that looked at metropolitan governance and issues related to regional government, and that task force, which was comprised of city officials throughout the region, did affirm the role of the Metropolitan Council in terms of doing both regional planning and the provision of regional services that we think can't be provided for as effectively by local levels of government. I think this is important to making sure that our region remain competitive and that the services that we provide with the resources we have are very cost-effective. I do want to point out that also our task force did encourage a broad look at the Metropolitan Council and our regional form of government to determine what we need it to do as we go forward. And so to that end, we do appreciate the conversation here today and look forward to working with you as we look at issues pertaining to the Metropolitan Council. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else care to testify for or against Senate File 1667? Seeing none, all those in favor of passing, Senator Chamber renews his motion that Senate File 1667
Excuse
be
me.
Recommended to pass and placed on general orders. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Okay, I think that no further business before the committee. This meeting is adjourned.
I get it very well.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
But I'm just saying that this, I accept this as a need to kind of balance that.
But take it here and move it to the start.
And I understand
that those hearings take place prior to that municipal.